Okay, translation. Please describe how many dissolutions there are for the elements of material nature and who survives after the dissolutions to serve the Lord while he is asleep. So the our acharyas, and Srila Prabhupada, everybody, of course, this is very, very, what, significant fundamental verse, because it's talking about this point that there are those who survive while he sleeps, imam, yeah, and that everything is not dissolved, that all the personal variety is not dissolved when the material world is dissolved. Okay, so the purport, Prabhupada says, in the Brahma Samhita 547-48, it is said that all the material manifestations with innumerable universes appear and disappear with the breathing of Mahavishnu lying in yoga nidra or mystic sleep. Everybody, we can all chant together here now. It's kind of fun. Yakaranarva jale bhajati smayoga nidramananta jagaranda sharomakupa adhara shakti mavalabhya param swamurtim govinda madhi purusham tamaham vajami. Yashyaika nispasita kala matavalambya jivanti loma vilaja jagan jagad anda natha vishnor mahansa ihayasya kala vishesho govinda madhi purusham tamaham vajami. Govinda, the ultimate and Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, lies sleeping unlimitedly on the causal ocean in order to create unlimited numbers of universes during that sleep. He lies on the water by his own internal potency, and I worship that original Supreme Godhead. Due to his breathing, innumerable universes come into existence. Yes. And when he withdraws his breath, there occurs the dissolution of all the lords of the universes. That plenary portion of the Lord is called Mahavishnu. And he is a part of the part of Lord Krishna. I worship Govinda, the original Lord. One thing here is that because it says that the innumerable universes are coming from his breathing and also from the pores in his body. Like that. So we can understand this very easy when we you have a cold mirror in front of you and you breathe on it, immediately it's covered with perspiration. You know? So of course the perspiration, assume that it's like that, it's little particles. Tiny particles of water, H2O atoms, H2O molecules, and probably collecting according to some kind of scientifically described arrangement into particles of water, you know, vapor coming out of our breath, but we don't see them. And similarly, of course, our body is also always perspiring. You know, we don't see that. But under certain circumstances, of course, we can see the water comes out of the pores of our body also, like that. And the opposite is true, too. We absorb things through our skin. And it's very important to get sunlight on your skin. Vitamin D production, which is necessary, I guess, especially for vegetarians, is very, very actively produced in sunlight. And, of course, recommending morning sun bath. Go out exposing yourself to the morning sun, and your skin will produce vitamin D, like that and so on. So actually, we're quite interactive with the world. And so Mahavishnu is going out of his pores of his skin. But it seems like he also withdrawing the universes back into the pores of his skin, maybe too. very dynamic place, you know, Mahavishnu Loka. Okay. So then Prabhupada goes on, after the dissolution of the material manifestations, the Lord and his kingdom beyond the causal ocean do not disappear. So for me, I was always understanding what the Karanarva, whatever it is, the causal ocean, Karanarva, whatever it is. But as far as I understand, this is the same as the river Viraja. The two are the same. And in the spiritual world, there's no cause and effect. Everything is simply carried out because of free will. Yeah? But in the material world, there's so many causes set into effect. Beyond the causal ocean do not disappear, nor do the inhabitants. Yeah, when everything is destroyed, the Lord's associates, the associates of the Lord are far more numerous than the living entities who have forgotten the Lord due to material association. Forgotten the Lord due to material association. Mm-hmm. The impersonalist explanation of the word aham in the verses of the original Bhagavatam, aham eva asami bhagavi, is refuted here. The impersonalist explanation of the word aham in the four verses of the original Bhagavatam, aham eva asami bhagavi, is refuted here. So, of course, you know, those are the nutshell verses of the Bhagavatam, aham eva asami bhagavi, nanyadiyat sarasaparam, Aham Yoga. And the rest I have to refresh them, refresh them. Viteratam yat na pratiyat. Yeah. This is a good thing if we have the time whenever verses are quoted to look them up and so on. So the Bhagavatam becomes a natural study guide for refreshing these verses. Very nice to make your own little Vaishnava verse book. Now, we kind of have it for our Bhakti by Baba program, kind of developing it. Yeah. Okay. But the word, that's the point, is the word aham eva asami bhagavi nanyadyat sarasaparam pashcharaham retachcha so vishishetisosmi aham. So three times Krishna says aham. And again, it's a very simple Sanskrit word. In the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, the Bhagavatam, in all the Vedic literatures, I have a suspicion probably you'd be very, very hard-pressed to find anything in the original Vedas or the, you know, established Puranas or Itihasas where the word aham means anything other than me. I am. Yeah, you know, overwhelming, you know, usage of the word. So then for the... it's so strong that for the Maya bodies to interpret this as something else is really, you know, really a weird thing. You know? And of course, the Prabhupada says they take it as that Krishna is not talking about himself here; he's talking about the principle. Before everything was the aham, and during everything is the aham, and after everything will be the aham. It's pretty weird. Yeah. I guess the primordial chunk, which caused everything, is a little bit even better off than the aham. But the chunk wasn't so good, so they made it the singularity. The singularity, the aham, and the chunk. I guess it's different names for the same whatever. But it's saying here it's refuted. It's refuted because he's asking how many people exist after the creation to serve the Lord. Probably the impersonalist can, you know, can reinterpret the Sanskrit because of many pronouns in some ways in the thing. But the sense is probably quite clear. The Lord and his eternal associates remain after the dissolution. Vidura's inquiry about such persons is a clear indication of the existence of all the paraphernalia of the Lord. This is also confirmed in the Kashi Kanda, as quoted by both Jiva Goswami and Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, who follow in the footsteps of Srila Sridhar Swami. Okay, so now we have a parampara citation from the Kashikanda, which I looked it up, is from the Skanda Purana. Kashikanda is part of the Skanda Purana. And it's being quoted by Srila Prabhupada, actually being quoted by me, Srila Prabhupada, Vishnath Chakravarti, Jiva Goswami, and Sridhar Swami. Na chaivante hiyad bhakta mahatyam pralayapari ato chuto kile loke saika. Okay, disappeared. I think disappeared here. Okay, 1 second. As suspected, everything disappeared in front of my eyeballs. Okay, so I load my own screen to look at it. My microphone continues. Saeka sarva govyaya. Quote, translation. The devotees of the Lord never annihilate their individual existences, not even after the dissolution of the entire cosmic manifestation. The Lord and the devotees who associate with him are always eternal in both the material and spiritual worlds. Pretty strong statements. Skanda Purana ki jai. Okay. So, very simple purport, very nice, kind of almost a standalone purport. But if you go through, I go there if you want to load it on your own screen. If you go to Brahma Samhita 548 and 547 and 548, we have then, of course, the commentary by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati. And what Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati's commentary to Brahma Samhita, as far as I know, is basically a translation of Jiva Goswami's commentary. So very parampara, like that. So it's very short, 47, both of them very short. And from the database.org, what it is, it's the old one, which doesn't exist anymore. It says, the subjective nature of Ananta, who has the form of the couch of Mahavishnu, is described here. Okay, first one. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who is assuming his great subjective form, who bears the name of Sesha, replete with all accommodating potency, and reposing in the causal ocean with the infinity of worlds in the pores of his hair, enjoys creative sleep. Okay. So this is different. It's different than the translation in the purport. Yeah? Yeah. A little different. Yeah. So it says, the subjective nature of Ananta, yeah, because the one here it says Shesha, yeah, and the purport says, the subjective nature of Ananta, who has the form of the couch of Mahavishnu, is described. Ananta, the same who is the infinite couch of which on which Mahavishnu reposes, is a distinctive appearance of the divinity bearing the name of Sesha. Yeah? Is a distinctive, okay, Ananta, yeah? Is a distinctive appearance of the divinity bearing the name of Sesha, having the subjective nature of the servant of Krishna. Yeah. Now this word subjective is kind of what you know, irritating my gall or something like that. Irritating my pig like consciousness. And I see, you know, Bhakti Siddhanta, it really seems that Bhakti Siddhanta gives us a real thrust and an avenue and doorway into the world of philosophical considerations of the 19th century, which are probably much more elevated than those of the 20th century in many ways. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And so he's talking about subjective, having the subjective nature of the servant of Krishna. Okay. Let's go on to the next one then, which is 48. Probably a little different translation again also. It's interesting. Okay. Brahma and other lords of the mundane world appearing from the pores, my goodness, of hair of Mahavishnu, remain alive as long as the duration of one exhalation of the latter, Mahavishnu. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, whose subjective personality, Mahavishnu, is the portion of portion. Okay. So, the purport's also very short. The supreme majesty of the subjective nature of Vishnu is shown here. Yeah. So we looked up the word subjective on Google, yeah. And it right away it tried to tell us to fill in subjective versus objective. So we went ahead and clicked that. And what it came back to them was subjective versus objective in terms of literature. And, you know, it says subjective refers to an individual person, his feelings, prejudices, intuition, and like that. You know? And then objective refers to the facts that can be observed. So definitely it was saying that subjective decisions are kind of wishy-washy, not so good. And objective decisions are ones that are just the hard facts and external and reliable, you know, and so on. So probably the way Bhaktisiddhanta uses the word back in the 19th century, you know, may have a different context than it does in the modern sense, which has become so materialistic kind of stuff. So we went ahead and then also went to the Wikipedia and finally the Britannica, and there comes exactly that point that somebody, some philosopher is writing the article, it looks like, and is saying this is a big topic in philosophy, you know, subjective like that. And subject refers to an individual like that, and he may relate them to objects, objective things. So it seems basically what Bhaktisiddhanta is saying here in very erudite language is that Sesha and Mahavishnu are personal expansions of the Lord. You know, they're not products of the material world. They're not objective expansions. Like the Mahatattva, then we would take it as an objective expansion of Krishna. And that Krishna knows the Mahatattva, and we can also know it to some degree. And of course, then Krishna knows us and the Mahatattva, like that. So, you know, kind of a simple distinction, but very fundamental, that Krishna has his subjective expansions, subjective portions, you know? And how many qualities of Krishna do they possess? Well, at least they possess eternality, sat. They possess consciousness, ability to know, chit, and ananda. They possess free will, like that. Yeah. And of course, these are very, very subtle topics. So what actually is pleasure? What actually is ananda? Like that. Yeah. Yeah. Goes on and on. It's a very logical perspective on this verse. And then what we were looking at next is if we go to one of the last chapters after addressing, one of the last chapters of the Krishna book. And this is the super excellent powers of Krishna. You know? And doing this is describing how one Brahman, you all know this story probably. One Brahmin, he was having children one after another, but as soon as the children would touch the ground, they would die. It was very distressing. And every time he would go before the royal palace in Dwarka and criticize the king, because if there's something so horrible as this, as a child dying before its father, or especially right after childbirth, then there must be something wrong with the king. And Ramachandra, when something like this was happening, he accepted it. Something wrong in my kingdom. I'm responsible for this, like that, and so on. So we can imagine the President of the United States when he's seeing, you know, drug addiction, abortion, poverty, so many things going on, robbery, thievery, dishonesty in business dealings, divorce, then he would take it as his own personal responsibility. That there's something wrong in the United States, and I am personally responsible for this. But of course, the full executive of the United States doesn't have that full authority also to take full responsibility for things, Okay. So then, Arjuna promised that he would kill himself if it happened again. And he was going to kill himself, but Krishna saved him and said, let's go look for the child. Okay. So then, I guess Arjuna went looking all over the place, and then Krishna said he would help him. So we have here, we kind of extracted it. We can read it. Of course, you can go there on the screen if you want to, I guess. After addressing Arjuna in this way, Lord Krishna called for his transcendental chariot. He mounted it along with Arjuna and proceeded north. Lord Krishna, the all-powerful personality of Godhead, could have brought the child back without effort. But we should always remember that he was playing the part of a human being. As a human being has to endeavor to achieve certain results, Lord Shri Krishna, like an ordinary human being, or like his friend Arjuna, left Dwaraka to bring back the Brahmana's baby. By appearing in human society and exhibiting his pastimes as a human being, Krishna definitely showed that there was not a single personality greater than he. God is great. That is the definition of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So at least within this material world, while he was present, Krishna proved that there was no greater personality within the universe. Okay, Krishna looks very nice. Seated on his chariot with Arjuna, Krishna proceeded north, crossing over many planetary systems. These are described in Srimad Bhagavatam as Saptadweep. Dweep means island. These planets are sometimes described in Vedic literatures as Dweepas. The planet on which we are living is called Jambudweep. Outer space is taken as a great ocean of air. Of course, this is not the air we breathe exactly, but it's the air of prana. It might say an ocean of gravity in some ways. And also an ocean of these different, you might call measure them as radio waves, light waves coming from the stars and everything else. So yeah, there's something there. There's gravity, there's all kinds of radiation out there they would accept. Okay. Outer space is taken as a great ocean of air. And within that great ocean of air, there are many islands, which are the different planets. They're planes, little planes. Yeah. On each and every planet, there are oceans also. And on some of the planets, the oceans are of salt water, and some of them are oceans of milk. On others, there are oceans of liquor, and others, there are oceans of ghee or oil. There are different kinds of mountains also. Each and every planet has a different type of atmosphere. There's the whole thing of cosmology, Again, if you take a geocentric model of the universe, why not? We live on the Earth, as opposed to a heliocentric model with the sun in the center. They're both valid mathematically. There's actually no difference between the two mathematically. Okay. So what you get the moon going around the Earth, probably in a little bit of an elliptical orbit. And, of course, you get the sun going around the Earth, probably also a little bit of an ellipse. Then you get Mars going, how would it go? Mars going around the Earth as it goes around the sun, right? So the sun's going around us and Mars is going around the sun. So what it looks like is that Mars is going forward, Mars is going backward, Mars is going forward, Mars is going backward, Mars is going forward, Mars is going backwards as it goes around us. It's something like that. The other planets, you should call it epicycloids, okay? It's like kind of like looking at a light on a bicycle wheel as it goes by you. It's going up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, like that, as it goes around you. Yeah. So, but that's the point of view from us as human beings. So from the point of view of the demigods, of course, these things are happening much faster, you know. And let's go up, of course, to the great sages, Maharloka, and finally Brahmaloka. And then you get incredible differences in time. Incredible. And so therefore, one rotation of the of Mars in this epicycloidal orbit going around the Earth is like, you know, one moment for Brahma, one blink of the eye, it's gone around so many times, it's unbelievable, like that and so on. And so for all practical purposes, it is a solid, right? It's a solid. It's a kind of like a donut-shaped solid because it has an epigee and a perigee. It goes to a certain distance away and a certain distance back. So it's describing that around the Earth are these ring-shaped planets, and then there's oceans in between and this and that, you know, and mountains. So our philosophical speculation, hoping for somebody to have the time and whatever to work it out, is that these are what's being described, you know, different planets, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, Venus, that they form these like donut-shaped rings around it because they're moving so fast from the point of view of the devatas, you know. And the oceans, okay, getting more speculation here, on the, which are closer to the sun, when we get Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. On Venus, you're probably going to get that oil, things that are oil on the Earth will actually become vapor. You know, you can produce enough heat so that all the kind of canola oil in your ISKCON temple walk for the Sunday feast turns into a vapor. You can vaporize the canola oil. No. Yes. And so then on Venus, which is a hotter atmosphere, therefore we might get what? We might get atmosphere of oil, an oily atmosphere. Strange, huh? I got to breathe the oily atmosphere on Venus. And things that are solid here, like ice, you know. I wonder what, not ice, what else was it? Got something solid, you know, I don't know, something solid which will become a liquid there. I don't know, something around here which is some kind of different resins or something. You know, they're solid, you heat them up, okay? So things that are solid, maybe oceans of ghee. Maybe on Venus, the ghee, which is solid, becomes an ocean, okay? When you get to Mars, it becomes a vapor. Other side of the coin, you get alcohol here, which is always a vapor in our atmosphere. When you go to Mars and you get an atmosphere, alcohol always becomes a liquid then. To get oceans of liquor. So, of course, it would be kind of easy to test in some ways, looking at the distances and the atmospheres. So, anyway, that's a little speculation about how the Bhagavatam is describing the universes from the point of view of a yogi who's going in here and there. And I guess if that's the case, then on Mars we're going to find a lot of good times. Maybe we'll find Spuds McKenzie there. Krishna passed over all these planets and reached the covering of the universe, okay? This covering is described in Srimad Bhagavatam as a great darkness. The material world as a whole is described as dark. In the open space, there is sunlight, and therefore it is illuminated. But in the covering, because of the absence of sunlight, it is naturally dark. When Krishna approached the covering layer of the universe, the four horses which were drawing his chariot, Shaibya, Sugriv, Megapushpa, and Balahaka, all hesitated to enter the darkness. What Sugriv means good neck, right? And Mega means cloud? Flower clouds? I don't know. These are all eternal personalities. They must be really cool guys if you met them. They're nice horses. All hesitated to enter the darkness. This hesitation is also a part of the pastimes of Lord Krishna. Because the horses of Krishna are not ordinary. It is not possible for ordinary horses to go all over the universe and then enter into its outer covering layers. As Krishna is transcendental, his chariot, and his horses and everything about him are also transcendental. Beyond the qualities of this material world. You should always remember that Krishna was playing the part of an ordinary human being. And his horses also, by the will of Krishna, played the parts of ordinary horses in hesitating to enter the darkness. Like an adult playing with kids, you know. Oh my goodness. Yeah. That's scary. Krishna is known as Yogeshwar, as stated in the last portion of the Bhagavad Gita, Yogeshwara Harihi. All mystic powers are under his control. In our experience, we see many human beings who have yogic mystic power and who sometimes perform very wonderful acts. But Krishna is understood to be the master of all mystic power. Therefore, when he saw that his horses were hesitant to proceed into the darkness, he immediately released his disc known as Sudarshan Chakra, which illuminated the sky 1,000 times brighter than sunlight. Well, I guess you can leave some. Arjuna must have put on some sunblock at this time and some dark glasses. The darkness of the covering of the universe. Yeah, okay. Is also a creation of Krishna's. And the Sudarshan Chakra is Krishna's constant companion. Thus he penetrated the darkness by keeping the Sudarshan Chakra before him. Srimad Bhagavatam states that the Sudarshan Chakra penetrated the darkness just as an arrow released from the Shrangabo of Lord Ramachandra penetrated the army of Ravana. Su means very nice and Darshana means observation. By the grace of Lord Krishna's disc, Sudarshan, everything can be seen very nicely and nothing can remain in darkness. Say, we're talking about this. This would be a great, you know, for 30, $45 million budget movie like that. You know, we could do fantastic special effects with IMAX and everything else. It would be terrifying. You know? But, well, I guess it shouldn't be terrifying, but it should definitely make you, you know, feel impressed and a little bit, you know, humble and a little bit frightened, maybe. A little bit awestruck. Thus, Lord Krishna and Arjuna crossed over the great region of darkness covering the material universe. Arjuna then saw the effulgence of light known as the Brahma Jyoti. The Brahma Jyoti is situated outside the covering of the material universes, and because it cannot be seen with our present eyes, the Brahma Jyoti is sometimes called Avyakta. This spiritual effulgence is the ultimate destination of the impersonalists, known as Vedantists. Yeah. The Brahma Jyoti is also described as Ananta Param, unlimited and unfathomed. When Lord Krishna and Arjuna reached this region of the Brahma Jyoti, Arjuna could not tolerate the glaring effulgence, and he closed his eyes. Lord Krishna's and Arjuna's reaching the Brahma Jyoti region is described in the Harivamsa. In that portion of Vedic literature, Krishna informs Arjuna, "My dear Arjuna, the glaring effulgence, the transcendental light you are seeing is my bodily rays." I think the Harivamsa is a part of the Mahabharata, or commentary on it. "O chief of the descendants of Bharata, this Brahma Jyoti is I myself. As the sun disk and the sunshine cannot be separated, Krishna and his bodily rays, the Brahma Jyoti, cannot be separated. As Krishna claimed, the Brahma Jyoti is he himself." This is clearly stated in the Brahma and the Harivamsa, where Krishna says, "Aham Saha." The Brahma Jyoti is a combination of minute particles known as spiritual sparks or living entities known as Chitkana. The Vedic word Soham, or I am, the Brahma Jyoti can also be applied to the living entities, who can also claim to belong to the Brahma Jyoti. In the Harivamsa, Krishna further explains, "This Brahma Jyoti is an expansion of my spiritual energy." This Brahma Jyoti is an expansion of my spiritual energy. Okay. Krishna told Arjuna, "The Brahma Jyoti is beyond the region of my external energy known as Maya Shakti. When one is situated in the material world, it is not possible to experience this Brahman effulgence. In other words, in the material world, this effulgence is not manifested, whereas in the spiritual world, it is manifested." That is the purport of the words vyakta, avyakta in the Harivamsa. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is also said, avyakto, vyakta, sanatana. Both these energies are eternally manifested. After this, Lord Krishna and Arjuna entered a vast spiritual water. The spiritual water is called the Karana Ocean, which means this ocean is the origin of the creation of the material world. Origin of the creation. This place is also known, here it is, okay. This place is also known as Viraja, because it is free from the influence of the three qualities of the material world. In the Mrityunjaya Tantra, a Vedic scripture, there is a vivid description of this Karana ocean or Viraja. It is stated there that the highest planetary system within the material world is Satyaloka or Brahmaloka, beyond which are Rudraloka and Mahavishnuloka. Regarding this Mahavishnuloka, it is stated in the Brahma Samhita, Yakaranarnava Jale Bhajati Smayoga Nidramananta Jagaranda Saromakupa. The verse we're quoting before. Lord Mahavishnu is lying in the Karana ocean. When he exhales, innumerable universes come into existence. And when he inhales, innumerable universes enter into him. In this way, the material world is generated again and withdrawn. When Lord Krishna and Arjuna entered the water, it appeared that there was a strong hurricane of transcendental effulgence blowing. So everybody who's been to Mayapur or places like that, you know, right before these monsoons come, everybody's running to close the windows like that and batten down the shutters. At the same time, it's a very wonderful experience, you know, make my day. It's just coming and it's so exciting and wonderful, you know, before the typhoon comes. Okay? There was a strong hurricane of transcendental effulgence blowing, and the water of the Karana ocean was greatly agitated. By the grace of Lord Krishna, Arjuna had the unique experience of being able to see the very beautiful Karana ocean. Accompanied by Krishna, Arjuna saw a large large palace within the water. There were many thousands of pillars, and columns made of valuable jewels, big, gigantic diamond crystals, uncut, gold in their nature. And glaring effulgence of those columns was so beautiful that Arjuna was charmed by it. Whoa. Within that palace, Arjuna and Krishna saw the gigantic form of Anantadeva, who is also known as Shesha. Lord Anantadeva, or Shesha, was in the form of a great serpent with thousands of hoods, each one decorated with valuable effulgent jewels, beautifully dazzling. Each of Anantadeva's hoods, where's it? Here we go. Okay. Oh, had two eyes, which appeared very fearful. Oh my goodness, two eyes. His body was as white as the mountaintop of Kailas, which is always covered with snow. His body was white. His necks were bluish, as were his tongues. Thus, Arjuna saw the Sheshanaga form, and he also saw that on that very soft white body of Sheshanaga, Lord Mahavishnu was lying very comfortably. He appeared all-pervading and very powerful, and Arjuna could understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead in that form is known as Purushottama. He is known as Purushottama, the supreme or best personality, because from him, from this form emanates the material world. Because from this form emanates within the material world another form of Vishnu known as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. The Mahavishnu form of the Lord is also called Purushottama, because he is beyond the material world. Tama means darkness, Ut means above, transcendental. Therefore, Uttama means above the darkest region of the material world. Okay, therefore he's Purusha Uttama. Arjuna saw that the bodily color of Purushottama Mahavishnu was as dark as a new cloud in the rainy season. Okay, he was so Sesha is bluish and white on the outside, and Mahavishnu is like a dark cloud appearing all pervasive. He was dressed in very nice yellow clothing. His face was beautifully smiling, and his eyes were like lotus petals, were very attractive. Mahavishnu's helmet was bedecked with valuable jewels, and his beautiful earrings enhanced the beauty of the curling hair on his head. where Mahavishnu had 8 arms, all very long, reaching down to his knees. His neck was decorated. With the Kaushtubh, a Kaushtubh jewel, and his chest was marked with the symbol of Sri Vats, which means the resting place of the goddess of fortune, Sri Vatsa. The Lord wore a garland of lotus flowers down to his knees. This long garland is known as a Vaijanti garland. The Lord was attended by his personal associates, Nanda and Sunanda, and the personified Sudarshan disc was also standing by him. So it is like, because of these things don't exist, you know, if there is no eternal existence of the Lord and its paraphernalia, you know, outside his material world, and the personality within this world is just kind of a reflection that appears sometimes, that means somebody had to, you know, somebody named Bhopadev or something had to invent the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. Wow. You know, we can see it in inventing Harry Potter, because people take it as an amusing diversion, you know. And I think there are plenty of Vedic literatures or things, Sanskrit literatures, which people know. They're inventions. They're stories for different reasons. Maybe Shakuntala, a story by Kalidas. People know this is a drama, you know, so on. But even you take Harry Potter and, you know, the Lord of the Rings, you'll find so many of these things are actually based upon you know, traditional ideas like goblins and hobgoblins and, you know, so many things like that, you know, so many things, you know. So there's already something in that. And to create these things and everything else, of course, there has to be some reward from society. But nobody thinks, and I don't think anybody in the future is ever going to think that, you know, Harry Potter and these things were actually things that actually happen, that they'll be elevated to that level of consciousness. And of course, the sophistication of the Bhagavatam's grammar and everything else indicates a very intelligent, you know, class of society. So it's such an effort to try and say that all these descriptions are just created by one monk named Bhopadev, and we're not even sure about that. Oh my goodness. Okay, so here are the beautiful descriptions of what the Lord is like, you know, outside the material world. The Lord was attended by his personal associates, Nanda and Sunanda, and the personified Sudarshan disc was also standing by him. As stated in the Vedas, the Lord has innumerable energies, and they also stood there in their personified forms. The most important among them were as follows: Pushti, the energy of nourishment; Shri, the energy of beauty; Kirti, the energy of reputation; and Aja, the energy of material creation. All these energies are invested in the administration and the administrators of the material world. Aha! All these energies are invested in the administrators of the material world, namely Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu, and also in Indra, Chandra, Varuna, and the sun god. In other words, all these demigods being empowered by the Lord with certain energies engaged in transcendental loving service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Mahavishnu feature is an expansion of Krishna's body. Okay? The Mahavishnu feature is an expansion of Krishna's body. Brahma Samhita confirms that the Mahavishnu portion is a portion of a plenary expansion of Krishna. All such expansions are non-different from the personality of Godhead. But since Krishna appeared within this material world to manifest his pastime as a human being, he and Arjuna immediately offered their respects to Mahavishnu by bowing down before him. So I wonder how big they were. Were they standing on, you know, I guess Anantasesha floating on the ocean? Was the chariot kind of floating in the sky and the imperial obeisance is from the chariot? Or was there a little place made for them to land the chariot? Were they the size of grains of rice in front of an elephant? Very good movie work to depict this. It is stated in Srimad Bhagavatam that Lord Krishna offered respects to Mahavishnu. This means that Krishna offered obeisances to none other than himself, because Lord Krishna is non-different from Krishna himself. This offering of obeisances by Krishna to Mahavishnu is not, however, the form of worship and known as a hanga pashana. Okay, kind of cut down here. And then Krishna talks to Arjuna and Krishna, and says why he kidnapped everybody and all these kind of things like that, so on. You know? So it's kind of our presentation here today. I hope we're still online there. Ramananda, are you still there?
Yeah, everything went smooth.
Okay, because right at the beginning, my connection got lost for the web page. So, Mahavishnu Ki Jai. Shantaras Ki Jai. Yeah. So any comments anybody has? I don't have any questions. Maybe some questions. Yeah. Cosmology or the existence of the spiritual world before the material world existed.
So what you're saying as far as the description in the Puranas and the Bhagavatam about the various oceans is just like if you took a firebrand.
Yeah.
And you start going real fast. It looks like a circle, actually. It's not. It's just moving very fast. So these oceans are like oceans of elements corresponding to our present solar system.
That's my speculation, you know, right. And but the thing is that's philosophical speculation, whatever else. And so we can actually go ahead and do the work. That's what Sariputta did. He did investigated these things and looked at them in terms of our modern knowledge and came back. You know, with the Bhumandala didn't mean the earth, it meant the elliptic, the orbit that the planets take in terms of the earth and so on. So it'd be a nice thing to see the order and see what substances are there and which ones would be liquid. Ghee is kind of ghee is a solid in Alaska in the wintertime, and it's a liquid in Panama all year round. You know, oceans of ghee, and also the words, other words, like that. So that's kind of my like suggestion. That's what it's talking about. Yeah.
But then, what about the universe beyond the solar system? It's so
that's
vast.
That's a whole thing because, the word Bhumandala, the word universe, and there are people who who've dealt with this, who've written commentaries. As far as I know, one of our friends, Dr. Samaras Bandhopadhyay, he even indicated to Sariputta one of these earlier discussions of the Bhagavatam's description, where it goes into some of these things. And Sariputta used that as part of his work. So there are people who have been trying to adjudicate these things. Now, the universe beyond our solar system is starting. As soon as you start talking about that, my God, it's just unbelievable what they're talking about. The amount of speculation that they get away with. Because, for example, what is the speed of sound? You know what is the speed of sound?
No. Well, the sound barrier, I don't know, 2,000
miles. But it's different in a metal, in water, and in air, right? It moves at different speeds according to the media, And even the speed of light, which, of course, is one of their most sensitive instruments. And, of course, then they use also other kinds of electromagnetic radiation, which they pass right back and forth between light, pretty quickly. That I think Einstein, that was his, with his law, his special relativity, was showing that light is bent by gravity. That was one of the whole things he showed that the Venus, when Venus came out from behind the sun, then it should have appeared a little bit before it actually appeared, because the light was hitting the gravity ball of the sun and being conducted around it like that, being conducted around it by being bent. Okay, so they're saying light is being bent by gravity, and then if gravity is not a constant, if it's more dense and less dense, is the speed of light being adjusted in whatever media it's going into? And if that's the case, then why do we assume that it's constant? They're saying that these nebula and stuff are like 100 million light years away. Light's going, 186,000 miles a second, 1,001. Okay, 100 and 86,000 miles. Okay, Baba. But still, of course, what, it takes like 9 minutes for the sunlight to reach the Earth or something, you know. So the closest star is three light years away. I guess Alpha Centauri. It takes three years for that planet to reach us. Now they're talking about, well, we know what's happening on the Crab Nebula and stuff like this and the supernova. And how far away are they? Well, they're 100 million light years. Okay.
Mm.
And so is there some possibility that along the way something happened? You know, there's a whole band of condensed gravity, you know, that speeds it up or slows it down, or, you know, maybe everything isn't that far away, actually, you know. You have some probes that have gone, what, they're going beyond the orbit of Pluto and sending stuff back. But it's like that. It's just, you know, their conception of the universe and everything else. There's one very nice guy. What his name is? Something Stoger, William Stoger. He's a Jesuit priest, and he's an internationally published astrophysicist, you know. Actually, in Arizona, there's Kit Carson Solar Observatory. It's not an optical observatory so much. It just observes the sun. And as far as I knew, last it was actually being run by the Vatican. You know? They have their claim to hard scientific work. You know? So anyway, I saw one lecture by him. And he said, to understand anything, you've got to have some time-space window. Like, we watch Ramananda, you know, for one day. Okay. Ramananda is like this. He is like that. We saw him for 24 hours. Okay. And we saw him from different angles. You know, we saw him from the bottom up and the top down. Okay. So you need a time-space window. You're looking at it from different angles and looking at it over time. So he said, the dimensions of the universe that we're talking about and understanding we know the universe, that if we had an angle on the universe from here to Alpha Centauri, and that's pretty big, right? That's three light years away. You know, if we could look at it from this side and that side, that distance away, which of course we don't do. You know, we look at it just from maybe New York to Brussels or something. And if we had a window which extended 10,000 years into the past and 10,000 years into the future, the amount of perspective that would give us that big of a time-space window is absolutely no different than standing on the Earth and taking one snapshot. Click.
Oh, yeah.
That's give you some proportion of what these guys are thinking about. And they're saying, well, therefore, you know, I've seen it recently. It was created, and then the globules form. They form the suns, and the suns form this, and they spout little particles. And only seven particles were spit out of the sun. They became planets. Yeah. So anyway, it's their description, modern science description of the universe, has a lot of things which personally, I would say, you know, very doubtful. And but the thing is then to adjudicate them, because when it says the Earth, it probably says it. I can't translate these things so technically as modern people, but here's some things. Okay. So Bhumandala sometimes is translated as the Earth. But it's not the Earth as we know it. You know, it means the circle, the locus, you know, of the Earth's orbit and influence like that and so on. So anyway, Arjuna went there.
Okay. Confusing.
Yeah. What is that?
But of course, the astronomers don't have any answers other than wild speculation.
I would say so. If you look at, like, historically, like the pyramids, of course, is a wonderful thing. Those are the many pyramids, and the whole thing on Egyptian architecture. Because part of architecture, archaeology, is there's not enough money to investigate Indian architecture, and there's too archaeology, and there's too much of it. But where you get to Europe and the Middle East, there's kind of a reasonable amount of it, and kind of falls in history. And Egypt, of course, is a nice place, I guess, because there's a desert. So it's like, kind of sits there. So many things with all the Indian Egyptian archaeological things. And the pyramids themselves, just the great pyramids, was at Giza. I forgot what it is. You look at this, some things, they go through one after another. Something like, I forgot what it is now, something like an unbelievable number of blocks. I don't know, maybe I'm thinking like, you know, 600,000, maybe somebody knows. And each one is the size, of course, of like, you know, a small house or four or five Cadillacs or something, you know.
Wow.
And so they show like some people trying to put a 2-ton, you know, what do you call it, a 2 or 3 ton air conditioning system on top of a 7-story building in New York. And it takes them 3 days to get the crane in place, you know, settled down. And it takes them 2 full days or something to get the whole thing lifted up and placed there and stuff, and then move the crane, you know. So these blocks are like maybe 5 times as heavy as this thing. Mm-hmm. And these guys were supposed to have nothing other than, you know, balls, croquet ball sizes of rocks and copper chisels, you know. And if they did it in 20 years, which is what the common thing is, the endologists were saying, or 25 years or whatever it is, they would have had to have put one block in place. And in place means, you know, in place means so precise that these things don't deviate like even millimeters sometimes in terms of size, overall size and orientation. Millimeters, you know. And so then it would have had to put one block in place like something about every 97 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah, every 97 seconds, 24 hours a day, right, for 20 years, right? And well, they had slave labor. I mean,
right.
your arm's gonna fall on beating these guys like that. Now they say later it wasn't slave labor. They were happy to work with their king, and they were even given meat and beer. You know? Okay. So many things, just really accessible things, that really show that, you know, even historically we don't really know what's going on. Modern science and everything else should be a little bit more humble. And open and Nobel laureates like Charles Townes, people we work with, he said that's why he and his friends are interested in different ideas and why the Bhaktivedanta Institute work, because for an honest person, it is obvious that we don't know how to explain all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Did we just read that it was geocentric?
No. The Bhagavat model is geocentric, yeah.
Actually, David Icke and somebody else were just making another video just recently. I saw it, and they couldn't but help also put in the present day model of our Vedic planetarium with Mahavishnu in there. It was so far out, I just couldn't believe it. I thought, wow, you know, because they are talking about the flat earth now. So they are accepting that it's the Bhumandala, which is the flat earth. So they're actually talking from Bhagavatam, yet they're not admitting. But, you know, it's coming into the main science now. Somebody's exposing it.
There was for a long time, the only geometry which was accepted was Euclidean geometry. And if you suggested any other geometry, it was really bad. You know, you were, of course, totally isolated from the academic community, even threatened, like, I guess, socially or something. So then one person, in an appendix to his father's book, and his father was a very reputable Russian geometer, mathematician, he suggested a polar geometry like that and stuff. And that would kind of slip in, and people accepted it, you know. So you see, like you're saying, what is he? First to come is in like as a joke. Probably said, what is it? First they'll laugh at you, then they'll attack you, and then finally they'll accept you. So we'll see different stages, and we can be ready. You know, we can present things in such a way that people will feel comfortable laughing at them. The next thing we can present things in such a way that we'll have a good fight. I've even seen this big people arguing with Sariputta, and they liked it. Now, they didn't accept it, but they liked having a good fight. And after that, then they went to say, well, And maybe they won't agree right away. You've got to let them have a fight, and this, okay, then let them go off and chew on it themselves for a while, and they'll come back, and they'll say, you know, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I was kind of, my mind, the first thing I thought, what do I have to be thankful for? My mind, what do we have to be thankful for? My mind, the first thing that kind of came in there, kind of like a little bit at an angle, but very prominent, and nothing else, was Srila Prabhupada. maybe you can look at something else in Jesus and my mother and father, you know, something. But really, I would say that this is objectively that what do we have to be thankful for? It's Srila Prabhupada. Wow, you know, what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is another holiday for Srila Prabhupada. Vaishnava holiday.
Okay, well, thank you, Maharaj. It doesn't sound like anyone else has anything they wanted to add or contribute.
Everybody's flabbergasted thinking about Mahavishnu Loka. It's kind of like a Sringar ticket never ends. Govindam, Adipurusham. It keeps on going on and on and on like that. I don't know what else Mahavishnu does like that, so on. Yeah, he takes some time off and, you know, plays croquet or something. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Maharaj. Thank you, Prabhu. All glory to Srila Prabhupada.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Wow.